This is the, I don't know if this is the largest panel at the conference or not. And no one that I've talked to on the board, and I'm on the board, knows how this happened. But we have maybe the term monstrous was meant to seem. Maybe that's what our theme is. We have a very intelligent and skilled and varied group of panelists, all of whom have edited or are editing things, but different kinds of things. And one of the things that several of us had conversations like, what do you have in common between editing an academic journal, a reprint anthology, a series of books, editing a book, editing a magazine, editing an online magazine? Well, it's an editor is someone who stands between the author and the reader, to some extent. But beyond that, there's a phrase that Ellen has, which I like. Beyond that, I think one of our themes is to try to find what kind of platonic ideal of editing there is. And the danger, of course, is that we will descend into complete incoherence. So our plan is to begin with complete incoherence and ascend from there. So I'm going to begin by... And for those of you who are just completely unaware of reality, Jim Morrow and Kit Reed and Peter Straub are reading over there, and China Mieville is being interviewed over there, and why are you here?
Rhetorical.
Oh, thank you. So what I'm going to do is... yes.
I certainly hope so.
Wow.
And the one thing that Ellen asked not to do was to ask what you do.
Specifically, technically.
Yeah, so I'm going to start by asking what you do. But not technically, not day-to-day. We don't want to know. I get in the office at 8:45. But since the term editing varies so widely from each of these panelists to the next, I think I will ask each panelist to introduce themselves by describing the kind of editing they do and for which audience. And I think we'll start with... let me introduce the panel, and then we'll just start. Anne Vandermeer. Art Evans. This is decaf, so if I fall asleep during the panel...
I'll poke you.
Okay, good. Nala Hawkinson. My name is Gary Wolfe. Ellen Datlow. Brian Atterbury, David Hartwell, and Gavin Grant. So I'm going to start with Anne just to talk about the kinds of things you edit and what you hope to accomplish by editing the things you edit.
Well, I've edited anthologies and magazines. Most recently, this is my latest baby right here, The Weird, which is 100 years of weird fiction. It's 116 stories, 110 writers. And magazines, my swan song issue of Weird Tales magazine, and I was only the second female editor of Weird Tales in 90 years, so I feel that's quite an accomplishment. I'm very proud of that. But my philosophy of editing and the way that I approach it is, yes, standing in the breach between the audience and the reader, but I also feel like it is my job to find the most amazing, best stuff that's out there and bring it to the widest audience I possibly can, and that's my philosophy of editing.
Art.
Oh, gosh, let's see. I'm managing editor of Science Fiction Studies, so that's academic criticism, I guess. I'm also general editor of a book series through Wesleyan University Press called Early Classics of Science Fiction. And last year, my co-editors and I co-edited an anthology called the Wesleyan Anthology of Science Fiction, you might be aware. Okay. So those are my three... different hats.
Nalo?
I am primarily a writer, but I have edited four anthologies of short fiction. Whispers from the Cotton Tree Root, which is Caribbean fabulous fiction, which actually came out of my first time I attended ICFA. Mojo Conjure Stories. Tesseract, which is a Canadian speculative fiction anthology that I co-edited with Jeff Ryman. And So Long Been Dreaming, Post-Colonial Science Fiction and Fantasy, which was an idea of my colleague Upinder Mahans, and we co-edited it together. I have also worked on individual writers' novels, which is a different thing for me. And for me, editing the anthologies is, I see it as curation, and similarly to Anne, I see it as what is the cool stuff I can find that other people might not, that I can put out there and for other people to read.
Ellen.
I was fiction editor at Omni for 17 years, and then fiction editor of Event Horizon for a year and a half, and then the fiction area of Sci-Fi Channel, sci-fi.com, for about 6 years. And I've been editing. Mostly I edit short stories. I have edited novels. I currently edit anthologies exclusively, reprint and original anthologies. And I see myself as someone who often can get a writer to create a story that would not exist. When I'm commissioning stories for my anthologies, many of those stories wouldn't exist without me or me and my co-editor, if I have one, encouraging the writer to say, I need this kind of story. So, okay, once I get that story, then you shape it, of course. But the other thing is, so I guess I see the editor as a tastemaker, partly. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, what Gary was talking about that we had talked about before we started, was to change the conversation or enlarge the conversation by bringing, for example, I'll talk about Naked City later. But
okay, but
having a subject that people think is one thing, but saying, no, it's not that. This is what it is. This is where it came from. And this is, you know, enlarging the theme that someone thinks is a particular theme, and there's more to it. Mm-hmm. So the enlarging the entire conversation between the editor, the writer, and the reader.
That's a concept I want to come back to. But Brian?
I'm the editor of the Journal of the Fantastic and the Arts, which is sponsored by this organization. So that's one of my main one at the moment. I have also edited reprint fiction with Karen Joy Fowler and Ursula Le Guin. We edited the Norton Book of Science Fiction, which I think did one of those conversational changes because a lot of the stories that we put in there have now become part of the academic discourse of science fiction, which I'm delighted by. I just completed editing with Veronica Hollinger a volume of essays on sort of theoretical approaches to science fiction, and particularly the shared quality of science fiction, the fact that it is a collaborative but not formulaic form of literature and or popular culture, which we're calling parabolas of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about some of the same things. I agree with Ellen that part of what one does as an editor is to imagine things into existence. That is sort of the way I see my job, is to see a potential kind of construction and then figure out exactly who to invite, what to do, what to bring together to make that thing happen. I'll stop with that.
David.
Yeah, I'm David Hartwell, and I have edited pretty much all of the various forms at one time or another. I've been a magazine editor, I'm a journal editor, I'm a book editor for Tome Books. I edited the Best of the Year anthology collaborative with my wife, Catherine Kramer, and I've edited a lot of what we would have to call big, fat area anthologies. They are not theme anthologies, they are idea anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the hard science fiction renaissance, or the space opera renaissance, or the dark descent in horror fiction. When I approach a project, I approach it with an aesthetic agenda in mind. I'm trying to formulate something through that book, and the stories are generally selected as examples of what it is I wish to formulate. An example, for instance, is The Dark Descent. I wanted to use The Dark Descent to describe the evolution of horror short fiction over 100 years at a time when short fiction was becoming the less central to the enterprise of horror and the novel was becoming more central. This was a book that couldn't be done today because you couldn't get the requisite permissions to do it. but I'm proud of that particular object, which is still in print after 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I am proud of the New York Review of Science Fiction, which was founded in part to keep the serious discussion of science fiction from falling entirely into the hands of academics.
Although academics have published there.
We have. In fact, most of the leading academics in the field have published in the New York Review of Science Fiction, but I'm also very interested in publishing serious and thoughtful discussion by writers and fans and simply knowledgeable readers, and I do that all the time. We try to find ways to discuss the literary history of the field and to discuss personal memoirs, even. I've published memoirs by Robert Sheckley and a large number of other people. As a tour editor, I do almost entirely fiction. I do science fiction and fantasy. I do novels, commissioned and by anthologies. But generally, it's novels, because that's where the field is right now, commercially. And wearing that hat, I am a commercial editor. I've done this for a number of years. My first major twist was when I was allowed to edit the Timescape line at Simon & Schuster in the late 70s and early 80s, when I walked in with the idea that I was going to change the nature of science fiction and make it form more easily and pleasurably read by adults, because the major market up to that point, and we have statistics to prove it, was teenagers and young adults. By young adults, I mean college age. The science fiction audience at that point pretty much ended at age 25 to 30. That's not true anymore.
Now it's geriatric.
Yeah.
We got
older.
I am also what I would have to characterize as an old line editor, in that I do not merely acquire things, but I edit them textually. And this is no longer the standard in commercial editing, and I am sorry for it.
I will add a footnote. Well, Gavin, we're going to start the conversation until we hear from Gavin.
My name is Gavin Grant, and I am the managing editor and publisher of Small Beer Press, so acquire books and edit some, and my wife, Kelly Link, edits the other part of those books. I've been a reprint editor with Ellen on the Years Fantasy and Horror, and been a short story editor on Lady Churchill's Rosebud Rislet for since 1996, buying short fiction, and have done one anthology so far, I think one original anthology, Steampunk, a young adult anthology with Kelly. And the editing has always seemed to me a very enjoyable and yet also frustrating enterprise, where you can only work with what you have. So you can go in with the idea that you're going to get, you know, the best thing in the world, but then you are given this, that, and the next thing, and it is your job to try and make this, that, and the next thing into something better, something that is the best thing in the world. And part that I think I enjoy the most is that with our zine, with our books go out, and some of those are debut authors, some of those are authors like Nancy Press, who have been much acclaimed for many years. But it's the new authors that come to Lady Churchill's that are kind of the most surprising and the most fun people to work with, because even while working on the Years Best Fantasy and Horror for 5 years, we would get submissions from people I'd never heard from, never heard of. And at that point, when you're doing a year's best, you know pretty much every author in the field, because you are just reading every day everything that you come across. And the fact that new authors still come to the zine is the best part. It means that you also do a lot more line editing and a lot more getting in there and doing real editing than you might if you're just taking stories from mid-list professionals all the time. But that is boring. So
actually, I'd like to make a short comment.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've most enjoyed is being the editor of what I would consider some of the best writers in the science fiction field. Joanna Russ and Samuel L. Delaney and Robert A. Heinlein and Frank Herbert and Philip K. Dick. Nancy Kress, in fact.
My parenthesis to that, if you're not going to mention this, what I would think is the most frightening job in all of editing is what David does. He edits Gene Wolfe's novels.
What I meant to say was, in fact, that, you know, I have tried to hone my talents so that I can actually work with the best writers in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Because why settle for people who are not the best writers in the field? I like to work with all writers, and I like to work with first novelists, too. Mm-hmm. But I like to work with the best writers in the field, because that's what I've devoted my life to.
I actually love developing new writers. In short fiction, I think it's very different. I mean, not that different, but I'm happy. You know, yes, in an anthology, you need the big names, mid-list names, but it's always a joy to find, especially with the best horror of the year, where, as Gavin says, it's incoming, constantly incoming. And even though it's supposed to be, it's all published, it's still, some of it's very slush-like. You know, it's like really bad quality. But you find new writers. I mean, every year, this year, or rather last year, maybe it's this year, the forthcoming book has like four writers who I'd never edited, who I'd never even read before. Or I might have, but the stories didn't stick in my mind. And that's, to me, that's not line editing. I mean, that's picking things, but still it's finding these new writers. And if I do find them and use them in the year's best, then I may ask them to do something for an original anthology and work. And, you know, so constantly reading new writers and discovering, but having to notice new writers, I really enjoy encouraging them and seeing them grow.
No.
Yeah, I that's very much part of what it's like for me when I do it, but I find that doing editing as me means that there is, to put a very bald pun on it, a different color to it, because it means that people bring stories to me who might otherwise not submit to other places. Mm-hmm. It means they create stories for me that they might otherwise not. And so it feels that there's a responsibility there to, as much as possible, foster those stories and sort of open those doors that otherwise feel kind of closed. And one of the things I find I have to deal with is people saying that the fear out there that if you select for writing from a particular marginalized group, that the quality of the anthology will suffer. And there are a couple of things buried in there. One is a valid concern, but that I think takes the wrong end of the process. It doesn't really understand how editing works. Buried in there also is something that the idea that if you select works by writers of color or women writers or queer writers or Caribbean writers, the quality will suffer. And my response to that is, fuck you. But I found having to do it and having to deal with that very valid concern that when you are selecting the works, you need to be selecting for quality of the writing, but you don't look at who are these groups of people? Am I getting enough black writers? Am I getting enough, you know, XYZ writers? You don't do that at the point where you get the submissions. That's the wrong end of the process. And of course it will affect the process. You do it when you're inviting the submissions.
Yes.
And there's a whole set of processes around making sure those doors are open that in some ways can be easier for me because I represent so many of those groups. But I think what I have to bring to this panel, if anything, because I don't do that much editing, is that process of opening it up at the front end so that when you get the stories, you can completely ignore who's submitted them. At that point, I'm not even looking at the cover letters and read the stories and select for quality.
Mm-hmm.
A sort of follow-up to that is the idea that what the editor has to be aware of is where this is going to fit into that conversation. The individual writer doesn't have to really think that through. But the editor has to think, okay, this is out there, this is what people are going to think, this is how they're going to react, this is what they expect, here's how I change that, or build on it, or amend it in some way. And I think that it's partly the a matter of finding out who to include, but it's also packaging and it's finding the rhetoric.
Well, packaging don't always have usually.
I don't mean like cover. Oh. I mean just what do you call it? Where do you publish it?
What's the shape of an anthology?
What do you shape it? Yeah, how do you shape it?
Oh, but Nancy had a comment.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Noah as a sort of follow up to what you just said. What if you go through those initial processes and you're still not, and the doors are open, and you're still not getting the balance you want? I had dinner with Sheila Williams last night, and she was saying that as of this year, she only has 20% women published in the magazine, in Asimov's. And she knows very well that she's going to be in trouble if it doesn't change by the end of the year. But I think we would all agree the doors are open to Asimov's, as open as they're going to be. And Sheila is not a biased editor. She picks those stories that she genuinely likes. But still she's worried about this, even though she doesn't have a balanced, or anywhere near a balanced gender representation. What do you do when it just happens?
Well, can I answer this? I mean, or ask a further question that you may not know. How does she go out to... I mean, when I want stories by writers, I would actually go... But that's what conventions are for.
Yeah,
you go and nag the writers you want to submit,
or not
Sheila
even
does
can.
It.
Does she?
Yeah,
can
yeah. I would argue that Asimov's is very open, but still not as open as would encourage some writers to submit stories, because you're not going to find them all at conventions. A lot of
women
the people.
Women writers.
Yeah, a lot of the people I'm getting to submit would. Some of them would never, it would have never occurred to them to submit to a genre anthology. They're doing the writing, but they're not in the field. So you end up having to go out beyond that. The other thing is that I'm probably in the aggregate, if you look at Sheila's work, it sort of balances out. It's not going to balance out every year. She can't be responsible for that. But
you will hold her responsible.
Yeah, sure. And that's a fear I face too. And she is clearly taking the responsibility, but it's not a statistical sort of, it's not going to always balance out.
So do you all see it as part of your editing job to go after women writers, minority writers, whatever?
I definitely
yes,
do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, why am I doing this?
Retails for every story that came in from a female writer, I had 20 stories from male writers.
Mm-hmm.
That was the kind of what I was getting into my slush. And so, yes, you do have to do that outreach, not just to look for this gender balance or anything else, but you want to get the best stories and you want to have diversity, because otherwise you're going to have a boring project. If every single story is the same old, same old, same old perspective, you want to reach as far and wide as you possibly can. It is difficult to do that. I know that as editors, it's very easy for us to fall back into our comfort zones and deal with the writers that we already have relationships with and just kind of go to them because we know what we're going to get. But when you have to make that leap and put yourself out there and maybe get uncomfortable and maybe, approach writers that you don't have a relationship with and see what's going to happen. I mean, the worst that's going to happen is they're going to say no. But you have to keep hitting on those doors. And that's one of the reasons why my philosophy with these anthologies is to try to make them as open as possible, because it is easy to fall back to what I'm comfortable with and who I already know. But if I don't put it out there and make all of these projects I do as open as possible so that anyone can send me anything or I can get recommendations from other people, how else am I going to know? I can't know everybody and see everything.
Yeah.
When I started editing at Omni, I deliberately went after writers, mainstream writers, just writers whose work I liked, who I thought had marks of the fantastic in it. And I asked a lot of people. I mean, I got a William Burroughs story. That's how Joyce Carol Oates started writing for me. William Kotzwinkle, T. Corrigan Boyle. I deliberately went after, and a lot of people said no. There was apparently, I think I asked Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Marquez.
Or I think I wrote him a letter, because I didn't remember this, but someone's going through my papers. So you wrote a letter to him. Did he ever answer? I said no. But I asked him for a story,
Look, there's a great deal of difference among the genres and subgenres in what you can accomplish. I mean, it's very, very difficult to get women writers to engage with science and science fiction.
Nancy's been making this argument forever. I'm sorry, not buying it.
I'll cite a conversation we had 25 years ago, you said you had started to write science fiction, fantasy, and had moved over in part into science fiction. And you said, boy, do those science fiction people want me. They want me to write for Analog. They want me to do this. They want me to do that. And I said, yes, because there are a minority of the younger writers are engaging with the science. They're moving into fantasy. And if you're in the science fiction genre,
I have a fuller answer to your question too.
Yeah, please.
And that is, it is a process question. And when it comes to trying to open the doors, and I don't know that I'm always doing it the right way. I'm doing this by instinct and by having done years of work on access and equity in the arts. I open the doors selectively. And gradually. So my first round of invitations, because usually it's just me editing something, I can't do an open call. My first round of invitations, I actually will make a list of all the writers who I think would not necessarily submit. So I'll make a list of writers of color, I'll make a list of queer writers, women writers, disabled writers, whatever it is, and make sure that it exceeds by at least 50% the list of sort of mainstream, the usual suspects. And I will invite them first. Mm-hmm. Once I've done that, then I invite the others. And that's how I try to... You have to try to... The balance is not even by itself. You have to do something to even it up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I just want to say one thing more, because I'm actually not on this panel. And I don't
mean... Oh, you are now.
Because I read hard science fiction and genetic engineering, because not a lot of women do this, you know, as you just said, David, sometimes I get invitations I wouldn't have gotten ordinarily. I've been invited in just the past year to submit to two anthologies that are very hard SF. And I know damn well that I would not have been asked had I not been a woman. In fact, one of the editors, who was less than discreet, said, "We got to have a woman on this project or we're going to get killed. Will you write something for us?"
Oh, okay.
You should have said, "I will," for double the price.
In a sense, I'm glad for it because it's a chance to showcase my work and because I do think women should be included in these. And I know there are not a lot of us that are writing the hardest of SF. On the other hand, a part of me has that feeling, well, you know, somebody else might be doing better at this, since I have to do a lot of research for it, and somebody else who knows the field, somebody male, might be actually doing better than this, and I may be in their slot. In other words, I feel sort of semi...
Oh, no, that's such a bad attitude.
There's no male writer who is thinking that.
If you do that,
no, I don't.
No male.
Other women see that you're in these projects. And they're like, oh, you know, I can do this too.
Yeah, I'm aware of that too. But I would still rather be asked just because...
I know.
Apart from gender, and I don't think that that's happening all the time. And it does make me feel a little uncomfortable.
The tokenism is a little irritating. Yeah.
No, sure.
Okay.
One of the things about genre is that it is a conversation.
Yes.
And that every time something is published, and especially if it's published as the lead story in a magazine or a prominent anthology, that's an invitation to other writers to do that says you might be able to do this, and it might actually make you some money, and it's worth doing. So that I think that your work, or I think Eleanor Arneson writes hard science fiction, although it's not usually called that.
Often she does.
Often, yes. And many others have inspired writers to come into the field who might not otherwise do so. And again, this is part of an editor's job, is to make that known and make that part of the conversation.
One of the things that's... a commonality which is emerging, and that you mentioned the conversation. And David and I spent decades with our mutual friend Charles Brown talking about the conversation, that is, and enlarging the conversation. When you talk about enlarging the conversation with women or non-Anglo writers, gay writers, minority writers, and you do this historically as well. You enlarge the conversation. For example, when art's selecting classic works of science fiction, in effect, you're showing the reader this is a way to read the history of the field.
Exactly.
Or in the same, just to mention another example, in the case of Jules Verne, you're showing readers that Jules Verne isn't nearly as bad as you thought he was from those earlier translations. So in each case, we're sort of shaping people's perceptions of the field. Whether you're doing this in an academic context or a reprint anthologies, you also have the issue with representation of women. If you go back to 19th century, representation of gays is problematical because you don't know.
Well, there wasn't an identity in the same way that it is now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Kevin, did you have something to...
No.
Oh.
Margaret, there's a moment in the past.
Okay.
Well, this was touched upon, but yeah, the broad universe list periodically has discussions about the imbalance of male and female authors in the SF magazines. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, which was touched upon tangentially by a couple of you, how much of it is self-fulfilling prophecy? The writer, the aspiring writer, looks at the magazines and says, well, this is a heavily male-authored magazine. I would have a better chance at this other magazine.
I can't deny that, that somebody must think that way, but the editor is, I think, pretty nearly 100% of professional editors would be perfectly happy to see a story by a woman.
Oh, yes, but if the women look at it and have this perception, then as I said, it's self-fulfilling prophecy.
Okay, Karen.
It's not conscious. It's usually not conscious. Those barriers aren't something that you sit there and go, I don't feel welcome here. It's just, it's much more intuitive, cultural. You just don't even think about it. You're like, oh, you know, those guys, I don't even think about it.
Well, the studies of women in the workplace, and I read a human resources report on this, is that generally in the workplace, a man will apply for a promotion even though he is not sure he is confident and ready for the job.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And a woman will not apply mm-hmm. unless she is confident and sure she is ready for the job.
Mm-hmm.
This is a piece of sociological information.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The problem is systemic. Yeah. It's happening on all sides.
Yeah. It's
a very large problem.
Yes.
I see a lot of males submitting things, and they think it's the greatest thing in the world, and the women are a little bit more hesitant, and they're insecure about what they're submitting. I know that's kind of a blanket statement, but
men are more willing to write crap.
Generally,
we submit it.
But what's interesting is that I was judging a contest for this British magazine. There's a British women's writers magazine called, and I'm going to say the name wrong, Mixlexia or something like that. But every year they do a contest where they have writers submit their work and then they have a guest editor who does the contest. And I was selected to do it this past year, and it was stories set 200 years in the future, so science fiction stories. And the editors of that magazine said that they got the smallest number of submissions, and they couldn't understand why more women weren't writing science fiction. So they asked me to write an essay about why are not enough women writing science fiction. So I really had to explore that, and I spoke with Cheryl Morgan because I know it's been a big discussion mm-hmm. over there. And the friendliness of the publishers and the reviewers to women writers writing hard science fiction. You know, those I see it turning around now. I see more of it happening now. Mm-hmm. But you know, and the stories that they gave me to read were awesome. They were awesome stories. And it was a really cool way to do that contest because I didn't know who any of the people were until the stories were published.
I think mm-hmm. part of the job for me is not just sitting there and doing the editing, and I think you're hearing it from everybody, is that you have to... Part of what I see myself doing is almost trying to teach a sense of entitlement to people who don't have it, because I'm mm-hmm. broke-ass, but middle-class. So I have a sense of I can go to that door and knock and assume that there's a chance it might be open to me. And I find a lot of people that I'm talking to who are otherwise marginalized don't. So teaching that sense of you actually get to is part of what I see the job as being. These are all little tiny, we're all doing little tiny pieces of it to make the change. And you ask about the tokenism, which I experience too, that you know someone's inviting you to do something because of who you are. And sometimes I will step back and say, well, here's somebody you could ask, or here are five more people you could ask, I'm busy mm-hmm. right now. And that means that you turn down work. But because I'm not that prolific, it's not that much of a problem for me. You couldn't do it anyway. Or you ask the editor if you can help.
I wanted to bring in the academic side of this because a couple of us are mostly involved in that. I believe that history is fluid and needs to be continually rewritten because what we think of as history is the product of a bunch of discourses like academic writing and reprint anthologies and so on, it keeps changing. There is no fixed history, although there was a past, but we don't have direct access to it, so we have to construct it. And the history that we construct affects the present and the future that we begin to develop. So we have to bring in the history of women writers, of non-Anglo writers, of writers of different forms, and say, these are really interesting. Pay attention to them. So, you have to write the articles. I seek out articles about things that have not already been discussed 100 times in order to broaden that other side of the conversation.
Well, the other side of the conversation is women that get written about. Mm-hmm. And think that one of the things, in science fiction studies, historically, certainly is not intentionally guilty, but there have been lots of articles about Joanna Russ, who is deservedly a great writer. I don't think I've ever seen one about Margaret St. Clair or about Zena Henderson, possibly. So part of this is not the fault of the editors. Partly is the academics or the critics need to know the women writers who are there.
Hardly anything about C.J. Cherry.
Yeah. I strongly feel that, in fact, every good reprint anthology is a work of revisionist history.
Yes.
When I do those, quote, idea anthologies, mm-hmm. I have that in the forefront of my mind. Mm-hmm. I remember when your anthology with Ursula came out and Catherine's and my Ascent of Wonder on Hard SF came out within a year of one another, I treasure the postcard I got from Ursula after our book came out, right after the Norton. She's saying, I hope you understand what I'm saying. I think it's a very, very good thing for the field to have these two books out at the same time. because it was two poles of a conversation that were attempting to revise the history of the field in different ways. Mm-hmm. I got more flack than I can easily say for putting J.G. Ballard in a hard science fiction anthology.
there is something that Joanna Russ, I think, wrote about once, which is another sociological phenomenon, mm-hmm. women get forgotten. That at any mm-hmm. one time, people have surveyed anthologies, there are always something like 7% women, and mm-hmm. 20 years later, there's still 7% women, and some of those who were in 20 years earlier have dropped out to make way for the new ones. And when people come up with even lists or I want to write about cyberpunk, they will start listing, and they will forget to mention Pat Cadigan or who else?
Melissa Scott.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They just forget. And mm-hmm. it's not willful, it's not deliberate,
no,
but it
I
happens. It has to be fought.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nancy. Did we introduce our ninth panelist, Nancy Press?
I just wanted to throw in some actual data, because I spent some time on it. A few years ago, I went through the entire CIFLA directory, and I categorized mm-hmm. everybody, male, female, or other. The other presumably know who they are, but either they have unisex names like Terry and Pat, or they're using initials, and I don't know them personally. And it came out 40% women. And then I went through the awards for the last 35 years. And women win awards in about 40%, which is about our representation. But we are overrepresented in the nebulas and way underrepresented in the Hugos. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I did the same research.
Yeah. Doesn't that say something about who determines those awards?
Yes, it does.
The statistics are very interesting. I did a poetry magazine for 24 years, and I was one of the editors, but a majority of the editors were women, including Lyndall Gordon, who wrote the biography of T.S. Eliot, and Carolyn Hacker, and people like that. And we went out of our way for more than a decade to encourage the publication of women in the magazine, with a majority of women editors on the magazine. And we started out with 27% women being published. And when we did women-only issues, we got, of course, filled them with women.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went back to the regular submissions, we got 27-28% women in the magazine. And that was true for 24 years.
It's also when you're doing a reprint
and
anthology.
We got, mm-hmm.
sometimes
70% of our submissions were women.
When you're doing a reprint anthology, sometimes the reason why you end up with what you end up with is getting the permissions. And when my husband and I were doing The Weird, you would not believe how difficult it was to get permissions from certain estates. Mm-hmm. Margaret St. Clair was one of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And months of fighting and arguing and back and forth before we finally got permissions to reprint one of her stories. And so if people don't know who she is, why do you think that is? Because your stories aren't being reprinted, because you have to fight. So this is another thing to consider, is that most of the stories that we had the largest problems with getting permissions from were written by women, and their estates were mismanaged, and, you know.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, the problem for reprint anthologists who want to do any sort of historical work is the bloody revised copyright law.
Mm-hmm.
These are not going out of copyright.
Blame Sony.
Yes.
Blame Disney.
Well, again, I think one thing that every editor of nonfiction, fiction, scholarship, books, whatever, has to realize, that readers have to realize, is that an anthology or a collection or a magazine or a journal is what you can get. I mean, it's essentially what gets submitted, who writes it, and whether they... I was working with the Library of America. We had some nightmare permissions problems that nobody anticipated.
Yeah.
And then we had some flat-out refusals. You can't have this.
And especially for Ann and Ello, I know... does that also feature in when it... because I know you guys have made a real effort to get international writers. Is that another hurdle?
Oh, yes. Translations. Wow.
Yes, translations. And then, right. So then you're dealing with, you know, who owns the rights and the publishers, the estates, the translators. And so it's more of a commitment. But the thing about this is when you're doing a project like this, I take my job very, very seriously, and I take this... I'm responsible for something very important. I consider it very important because with this particular anthology, it's 100 years of weird fiction. And I didn't want it to just be the usual stuff that you would figure, H.P. Lovecraft and, you know, whatever. But here I've got H.P. Lovecraft and Murakami in the same book. I have Jamaica Kincaid and George R. R. Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Together. So we talk about conversations, we talk about rewriting history. That was very important to us, that we do it a certain way, and this book nearly killed us trying to do it. But yes, and so there are certain things that we wanted to have in here that we couldn't get for whatever reasons, you know, permissions or this or that and the other. Mm-hmm. So we know there's probably going to be people saying, well, why didn't you put that in there? Well, you know what? I'm still proud of what we did, and I took it very seriously, and I thought it was important that what we were doing was going to be something that would last and get that conversation going.
Yeah, and I think change does happen. I remember reading the anthology Under African Skies many years ago and being very cranky because I couldn't identify a single African writer in it. And then talking later to Gardner, who had put it together, and him talking about trying to find African writers and black writers and not being able to, and thinking, well, if you were to do that today, because of the work that's happened, it would be much easier to do.
And with the internet too, I think.
With the internet, but also with people who've gone out there, I mean, and done things like saying to Jamaica Kincaid, would you submit a story to a weird anthology?
Mm-hmm.
And having Jamaica Kincaid have to think about, oh, I guess my work maybe does fit here. Or discovering that she's already thinking that and you didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
Some mainstream writers will say, are you out of your mind?
Yes, yes, no, you will get that. You know, but there's no... I don't write that stuff.
I was going to say, the agents for some mainstream writers will
not let them.
Yes,
let them even know.
I know.
Well, we didn't have any problems with the job. She was very gracious.
I appreciate too. Yeah, she's
great. Was happy to be. So that was great.
Yeah.
You know, when you come across someone where it's easy to get the permissions.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Somebody,
I've heard, yeah,
have a question for you.
Yes, yes.
Well, I was just wondering,
you're next.
Your mention of difficulty of getting permissions, which I was thinking about before you said it, and the conversation of shaping the history by what you put in your anthology, scholarly anthologies. When I edited Dracula, the Vampire, and the Critics, which was published in 89, that was pre-World Wide Web, and it was much constrained. I knew what I wanted in it. And I was much constrained by not only what I knew about pre-World War II, but being able to find these people. And the publisher left it up to me to find the people and get the permissions. And one, I had to track down on the phone in his department where he was teaching to finally get him on the phone in person to get the permission. And it would be much easier nowadays. But yes, some of the things that I might have wanted to put in, I just couldn't find the person.
What was your point?
Yeah, I wanted to respond to an earlier point Mr. Hartwell made, where he observed that fewer women were in the younger generation were engaging in science. I think a lot of problems with representation of science fiction, maybe how you classify science fiction, because I've read a lot. If you have aliens and spaceships in it, even if your science is atrocious, even if there's not an ounce of science in there, it's classified as science fiction. The hardest science fiction story I read last year was Kenyon's Tying Knots about the problem of protein folding, except basically no one recognized it as like the outstanding hard fiction, hard science fiction story, because it's not the classical trope. If we reconsider science fiction to be fiction that actually is grounded in science as opposed to fiction that has alien spaceships in it, I think you would find a much more ethical representation of people engaging with actual science.
I think
actually, no.
Mm-hmm. No.
The thing is that it has to be first of all, it has to be recognizable as a genre story in one way or another. I don't go look for something just as a spaceship in it. I look for something that actually does engage with science. Ken Liu had a marvelous year last year, published like 9 good stories, and I chose one of the year's best. But there are. It also depends on where you publish. If you publish a science fiction story in the New Yorker and it's not called a science fiction story, it's kind of hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or if it's published in, an online venue that is not a matter of a piece of the genre conversation currently.
Chattahoochee or theater.
Pardon?
Chattahoochee or theater.
Yeah, something like that.
There's a flip side to that, though.
The thing is that obviously, you know, when you're surveying for an anthology, you try to find things, but you don't find them all.
There is a framing effect to calling something science fiction.
Yes.
That people immediately start trying to figure out ways to read it as science fiction. And
mm-hmm.
Yes.
The Kessel and Kelly anthology, The Secret History of Science Fiction, did just that with a number of writers. And it actually pays off. You get interesting new ways to read some stories.
You look at things through a science fictional lens.
Yes.
And
it might be science fiction's biggest weekend ever with the Hunger Games, because last week it sold something like 250,000 copies just of the first book, and then the other books sold another 100,000 copies each. And then the movie's going to be seen by 10, 15 million people.
Yeah, they just announced that 4 other science fiction novels are going to be made into movies because of this, because they're kind of similar.
They're not going to be Edgar Rice Burroughs novels.
Which I edited at Timescape, 1981.
So it does mean that there's a generation of readers and their parents who are all going to see this huge science fiction thing. Mm-hmm. So it's a science fiction moment that y'all should go out and take advantage of.
Speaking of which, everybody needs to go see John Carter, which is being criticized as a flop, but it's actually a very good movie.
Mm. Yes. It's also going
to fight the
200 million is the latest loss. I wanted to go back to your point about women in science, because I think there's a certain amount of gender assignment going on within works that are accepted as science fiction. And I've heard readers tell me, for example, that, well, women write science fiction, but they all write about biology and genetic engineering and real engineering and physics and math and astronomy. That's what guys write. And
that's something we shouldn't take seriously.
Well, of course.
I've been told that because I come to conferences like this, I'm not a real engineer.
Okay. Jennifer?
I do think it's worth noting that the American culture is changing, and it's changing rapidly in ways that I'm not sure are entirely predictable. But I thought it was very interesting. Nancy might know about this year, but I noticed last year in the Asimov's Undergraduate Fiction Award, all of the awards were to undergraduate women writers except for one. It was entirely a group of science fiction writers who were girls, teenage girls. So the pool is going to be changing, and this will affect
everything. That just says the same thing as
two guys. The same thing as two guys. Entirely women, but one.
One out of look at that and the writers of the future and a couple of other things and see what's happening. I mean, I know, to my great dismay, Clarion doesn't admit people under 21 much anymore.
Mm.
I think that's a terrible thing.
I went to Clarion and there were I was 13. There were a couple of both guys I think who were 21, 22, and they found it hard. Because there were people there of all ages, and it's just 6 weeks of being ground down. It's easier if you have a little bit more to fall back on. You know that it's not about you; it's about the process on the workshop.
Yeah, well, I mean, we used to have
18-year-old Bruce Sterling, people like that.
Adolescence in America has also been extended. You know, if you are 18 in 1988, it's a different thing from being 18 in 2012, where you have no idea if you're going to go out of college with $100,000 in debt and live in your parents' basement for the next 15 years.
Yeah.
No, that wasn't going to happen back then, so things have changed.
Yeah. Yes, no.
There's been quite a lot of conversation about including women particularly in science fiction. And I think was it Nancy, you said, you know, you did some research where you classified male writers and female writers and other according to their names. I mean, it's relatively easy to tell if somebody's male or female from their name. As editors, what do you do when you don't know the writer, when it's a new writer, and you're looking to include, say, other minorities? So when you're looking to include queer writers, when you're looking to...
You can't tell that.
What do you do?
Pay attention.
The story, if it's good, you buy it.
Yeah. You pay attention, because sometimes it's important enough to the writer that they will have... The information is out there, and you realize that there's going to be a certain percentage of people for whom it is not important, and they won't tell you. Mm-hmm. And you just take in as much variety as you can, and that sort of comes out in the wash.
Also, names are not as specific as might be at first, as you might first think. So Gavin Grant is a pretty, you know, plain Scottish name, but the best known Gavin Grant in America is the black Caribbean basketball player in North Carolina.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, which Gavin Grant are you going to get a story from?
And if your names are all Eurocentric, then maybe the issue is something else.
But right? I think it's fair to say that the days are more or less past when Lee Brackett can start a career because nobody quite knows what her name is.
Mary Zimmer Bradley several times said that editors didn't care whether she was a man, a woman, or a trained monkey, just how good the stories were, and all. But also, she was sometimes mistaken for a man because of the spelling of her first name.
Right.
And I think she was being a little bit exaggerating the gender blindness of the
baby.
I don't know what you think.
Yeah.
So,
I also want to put in a word for treating this topic of inclusion as not just some sort of redress of past injustice or political correctness, that these are some of the most important voices in the field, saying things that haven't been said, giving perspectives that need to be considered. So it's not just let's include some women because they're women, but because they might have something more important to say.
Well, I think it boils better. Yeah, it boils down to you getting more writing, more good writing. And that's always a good thing.
I just, as an aside, because nobody's commented on this, although we posted the contents 2 months ago, more than 50% of the years past that Catherine and I did this year are women.
Yeah. And
yes. that just happens to be the case.
Was that the fantasy and the science fiction?
No, we didn't do a fantasy this year.
Okay.
Comment.
Actually,
Sylvia Moreno Garcia at Innsmouth Free Press is doing some fabulous work, particularly from a global perspective on Lovecraftian fiction.
Mm-hmm.
She's put out a really great anthology. I happen to be part of it, but Future Lovecraft is chock full of a real African, Asian, South American viewpoint on Lovecraftian fiction. And it's odd because she's a Mexican writer but living in Canada. And it's very...
I love the anthology of writers that Lovecraft would have hated.
Yes!
And she does a really good job of being inclusive, but probably not because she's intending to, but because she has an entirely different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Ellen, you started to say something.
It's just that in horror, it's a similar situation where there are very relatively few women compared to the male writers. And I think for the first time, I think I had more women this year in my best of the year than I've had ever before. I don't know what the percentage is, but it's pretty close. And those women are mostly unknowns.
Book of Cthulhu that came out from Nightshade Books, almost universally applauded. I did take some issue with it, because if you look at the story breakdown, 75% of the stories are less than 20 years old. Here, this is supposed to be a retrospective of post-Lovecraftian fiction, yet the vast majority of the book is all, most of the stories that make up it are still in print.
It goes back to the point that we were making earlier, that David was making earlier. If you're disagreeing with it, that means at least that the anthology had a point of view.
Yes.
Was it meant?
I would like to get back to some other issues in editing.
Yes, let's get back to some.
One of the issues we face right now is, how are we going to publish these things? Okay, this is a real issue for all of us. Mainstream publishing is in a lot of flux and change. Mass market publishing is on life support. That used to be the main source of income for mainstream publishing, mm-hmm. and it's just barely surviving at this point. And the reason for that is that the romance audience was more than 40% of all mass market publishing. And romance readers don't collect books. They don't save them. They give them away. They trade them. They sell them to secondhand shops. And so they were early adopters of electronic text.
I think the other question which you hear increasingly...
That blew a 40% hole in the mass market in 2 years.
The trade paperback option.
But the other issue, which is...
You can do that, but they just want to read something in a day and be done with it.
I'm hearing this.
$15 for all those books. Okay. So, paperback doesn't work.
That's certainly not true with the small ebook publishers who publish my work. They put out the trade paperbacks and people buy them.
Yeah, but they don't sell 300,000 copies.
But one of the other issues that's come up about editing when I talk to young people, especially, is who needs editors?
Exactly.
We can put the stuff up.
They can do it themselves.
You've got what's that woman
put it up on their blog?
Yeah.
And they're published as far as they're concerned, and they don't need anyone to fix it.
But increasingly, they're getting publishing contracts. After the fact. Yeah.
And they're getting edited, probably. Maybe.
Maybe. No, not usually.
Yeah.
No.
One of the great difficulties is that editing itself has been devalued enormously by the electronic revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody who publishes has always known that if you look at the bestseller list and you look at the quality of the writing, you're going to be unhappy. Okay? That the mass audience is, to a large extent, style deaf.
Mm-hmm.
Really don't notice.
Yeah.
Are you talking about Dan Brown by any chance? Dan Brown, for example.
Well, Danielle Steele.
Yeah. Well, yeah. She writes better than Dan Brown.
Well, she's dead.
I have a question for my fellow panelists. How do you react to being edited? Because I myself, when I get edited, I go through all of the stages of grief. And come out at the other end glad to have had the experience and having learned from it. But I hate being edited. And it has made me a better editor, I think.
I have a love-hate relationship with it. It has to be a moment of taking many walks around the block and admitting to myself when the editor's right. I love my copy editor to pieces, but I'm glad that he's not around when I'm responding to
him. I love to be edited, and I appreciate it very much because I don't consider myself a writer, although I do a lot of writing. Mm-hmm. So I have a great appreciation for someone who's willing to edit my work for me.
I'm very happy to have someone edit my nonfiction, whatever essay.
Yeah.
I was edited by Clifton Fadiman. The World Treasury of Science Fiction was edited by Clifton Fadiman, and he edited every single story note, the introduction, criticized my selection of stories, suggested other stories, dropped some stories. It was a marvelous experience, and from one of the great editors and anthologists of the 20th century, and I learned a great deal from it.
I find when I teach, now when I teach creative writing, I end up having a section where I argue for editors. Because of this idea that editors have become obsolete, and also the idea that editors are your enemies, where I found so much the opposite, and the surprise I get when I say, people become editors because they like writing.
I get to say something, and then Nancy.
Not every editor in the world is a good editor.
No,
my immediate reaction, because I just actually Brian just edited something that I wrote, and but my universal reaction is at least once, thank God you caught that.
Yeah.
I said that was right. But Nancy.
Yeah. When I get an editorial letter for a novel or something, I go through it and mentally I classify the suggestions in three classes. there's, oh, this is good, I should have thought of this. And I've had a lot of good ones like that, including from both Ellen and David. The second one seems unnecessary but harmless. The editor wants it, so I'll do it. And then the third is ones I'm going to take a stand on. You have to pick those, because if you take a stand on everything, well, you're going to end up being like Harlan Ellison and nobody will want to work with you. You have to pick your battles on the ones that are important to you and where you genuinely don't agree.
But see, I don't want my writer to roll over dead. I mean, when you're saying the ones that, unnecessary, but I'll do it because the editor wants it. If you don't agree, I want you to say that.
If they're unnecessary but harmless, why not?
That's why.
Yeah, because I'm trying to make your. I want to work with you, not against you, and I'm doing it, I'm saying it for a reason. I want you to at least question me.
Are reprint anthologies, therefore, easier because the authors are dead and can't argue?
They're not all dead.
Well, they're not all dead, that's true. Kevin.
I had two comments on this stream. One was a wonderful statement by Tracy Nielsen Hayden a number of years ago. When there was a bad copy editor in the St. Martin's pool, every writer, no matter how distinct their voice is in their fiction, sounds exactly the same in responding to bad copy edits. Because it is a universal...
Dungeon?
Oh, dear my God, what have you done to my work? And completely justified. And feeding into that, as an editor myself, the most liberating and useful statement I've ever heard on editing was from Mark Evanier, which is that it is the job of the editor to make the contributor look as good as possible. It is not the job of the editor to make the work that he wants to make, or she, I'm sorry. It is to make the writer look as good as possible. And of course a writer is going to have this horrified reaction to a bad copy edit, because it's a violation of the fundamental contract between the writer and the editor if you have disimproved the work.
We may be over-defensive about editors on the panel, but we should acknowledge that there have been editors who have not. Who told that famous story about H.L. Gold that he could... His talent as an editor was he could take a mediocre story and turn it into a good story. His problem as an editor is that he could take a great story and turn it into a good story.
Well, his real problem was he couldn't keep his hands off anything. Yeah. He would actually rewrite every single piece. And that was a legacy of an earlier kind of editing in pulp magazines, where it was automatically assumed that the writer was basically a hired hack, whose work would have to be improved and to make and contoured to the editorial stance of the magazine. That was a very old attitude. It was not an attitude in literary publishing. At the same time as Maxwell Perkins, editing...
Except for Gordon Lewis.
Yeah, except for Gordon Lewis. Who was in sometimes a really good writer on his own? But
I do recall...
That was a non-literary pulp attitude of the certain large numbers of pulp editors in the teens, 20s, 30s, and early 40s, which was when Gold came into editing.
But one of the things I think the pulp era did, I didn't grow up with it, but I remember that certainly by 1939 or 1940, science fiction readers were aware of an editor. They were aware of Campbell. They were aware that there was...
They were always aware. They were aware in 1926 of Weird Tales. I mean, Lovecraft's correspondence is full of, awful letters about Farnsworth's rights.
But I'm curious about the people in the audience having this reaction, because I distinctly remember when I became aware as a reader that somebody was editing, that I liked the magazine, the fantasy and science fiction better than I did Analog at that time. I recognized that Ballantine books were more interesting to me than Signet books were at a certain point. That Asimov's, when it changed editors, I noticed. And at some point, and Tor and Timescape, for example, was clearly identified with you, so...
I don't think this is quite neat, but I had the experience of being in the science fiction trenches in the science fiction bookstore for 8 years. And the magazine readers are aware of the editors, because the magazine readers, for the most part, are a very dedicated sort and have been for a very long time, because it's such an obscure bywater. the book readers mostly are not aware of the publishers and the editors, except on the broadest level, when there is a... They're aware of TSR as a publisher because they're producing a type of product that is the TSR product. But they're not. They're mostly not aware of Ace versus Del Rey versus Thor.
Yeah, okay. I find that too. And again, teaching creative writing and people are trying to make decisions about where they submit their work. And I say, well, which publishers do you like? And they have not, it hasn't occurred to them to look at their bookshelves and see if there's any kind of pattern.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I have become very much aware of Small Beer Press.
Yes.
Because pretty much anything that comes from them is going to be worth reading.
Fun. Yeah.
And that's not the case with some other...
For that's only true for, say, 98% of readers.
And Tachyon and a few other presses.
Well, and presses do have this.
One can work back from the product to the editor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in fact, somebody who's experienced will read three or four things from one source and say, ah, that is well edited. There's a good editor at work there behind this.
Well, that's what I mean, and there are recognizable names. I mean, Ellen is a recognizable name. That's a reliable book will come from this person.
But that's because I started in magazines.
Well, I think that may be.
Jonathan Shaw managed to get that reputation, I don't think from his magazine experience, I think with the anthologies.
Well, he was unknown outside Australia until he started.
Well, I guess I mean versus novels.
Yeah.
I mean, anthologies have your names on them.
People are like 10 books in 3 or 4 years, so it was very obvious that there was a name there. I think for your average anthology editor, it would be a lot harder to do that.
But there was a point also, okay, I'll use a counterexample because this is revealing my age again. There was a point also in my reading when I realized the name Roger Elwood on an anthology meant that these were stories that nobody else wanted.
Plus an R.A. Lafferty story to make.
Well, yeah, one or two good ones in there to make it worth thinking about. We had a
teenager, I quickly discovered that there was one horror anthologist, reprint horror anthologist, who I really liked and would buy his stuff, and his mind's gone blank on his name. Big Book of Horror and Supernatural, Human and Other Beings, and my mind's gone blank on his name, but as a teenager, in high school in the 60s, I would look for his anthologies. And my mind's gone blank.
Jeffrey?
As pointed out, in anthologies, the editor's name is on the book.
Well, that's true.
In novels, the editor's name is not on the book.
That's
right. So maybe somebody who's cognizant in the field say, this particular editor is really good, but people who just read as for pleasure won't even know who the editors are on a novel.
I don't know what the numbers are, but that was always obviously an issue with the long-form Hugo ballot. That so many
the readers... quote, best editor, Hugo.
Right.
Well, yeah.
The best editor, Hugo ballot, was entirely dominated for 25 years by magazine editors and me.
An editor's job to be...
I was the only book editor ever nominated for a long time.
You know, shouldn't the editor just be someone who makes something better if we're lucky, and then steps out of the way so that you have the reader and you have the writer, and there's a relationship between them rather than the editor getting in the way?
Well, for novel, maybe.
Well, you see, in the genre conversation, everybody gets to play. Seriously.
Yeah.
The reader gets to respond to the writer and to the editor, and the editor gets to respond to the writer and to the reader.
And we need to make
there's a complex whole communication going on there if the field is working properly.
I mean,
that's partially breaking down now because of the internet. The internet is diluting that.
I want to ask you a little more to clarify what you're talking about, Gavin. I mean, about that. Do you mean...
I mean, with all kinds of fiction, maybe nonfiction too, more with long form than short form. But, I know that if I... Like the Van Anne and Jeff's anthology, I know that it's going to be, a certain quality. And I know that if you have a book out, it's going to have a certain quality. But for the most part, I like to read things without having... too much of a gatekeeper between me and the writer.
You're just undermining the compliment that Brian gave you about Small Beer. because there's a distinction between line editing and acquisitions. We learn to trust Small Beer or Tachyon or Nightshade because of what they're going to.
If you like our proofreading, you know, that's mostly Paul Whitcover.
Oh, yeah, you publish lousy.
He is unto a god.
He is.
So you publish lousy novels, but they're really well proofread? We trust the name because we realize you're going to publish a Nancy Kress book.
Now, the reason there's a Hugo for, like, best fan editor and people like that is that everybody gets to play. Everybody is supposed to be able to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, that's true.
So go to a science fiction convention, you'll find professional writers and fans on panels together.
John wanted to make a...
I just wanted to... And my own experience is doing these series of anthologies with Jim Kelly for Tachyon, and it's been very interesting because I was a huge fan of stories when I was a boy, and I loved reprint anthologies, and there's certain editors that I would really read, of course, Judith Merrill, but Groff Conklin, and they were always intelligently selected stories and are put together. Well, he didn't have much of a thesis with his anthologies, but Damon Knight always was, and I'm not talking about the original Orbits, I'm talking about his reprint book. So, in my mind, what we were going to do was do a series of books that would be, I don't know if they necessarily had a thesis. Well, we didn't originate all of the topics. Some of them came to us from Tachyon, but once we took on a project, we've always wanted to make it somehow a thoughtful book and have something for the reader to seize onto and chew, you know, with it and maybe argue with, certainly argue with a lot of the things, and also to put the stories in a context where you might see them in a different light, juxtaposing stories that you might not have seen together in the same place, and it seems to me that that's a valuable job for an editor to do. Maybe you're getting a little bit between the reader and the story, but I always think when I'm sort of like an impresario.
Yeah, you're leading.
Over here in this ring, we have.
You're a curator.
Well, exactly. Yeah, a curator is a good word.
Like, you know, Gary, I'm trusting names. It's like, okay, we trust names. I mean, I love to read first novels, but if Ursula Gwynne publishes a new novel, I'll read that. Perhaps before the first novel.
But I think the point also that John is making, and I see this in your anthologies as well, is that one thing an anthologist can do that a critic can't, a critic can write an essay making an argument about mainstream science fiction and allude to a lot of stories. You can put the stories in front of us. So it's essentially, it's a curatorial exhibit of an argument that you're making.
Yes, that's...
Yes.
Yeah. No. I have a question about sort of the invisibility of the editor that actually ties back to the question of accessibility and sort of because from say people read something and say, "Wow, this is amazing. I would like to write something like that. I would like to send it to," and then the editor's name isn't there. Like, so I wonder whether sort of putting the editor, not necessarily on the cover, but making that...
If you read something from Faber and Faber, or stories you wrote, the editor's name's not going to be there, so you do have to do a little bit of hunting, you know, whether it's the acknowledgements, the web, something. So yeah. It can be found.
I know it can always be found, but I was thinking more in terms of that question of trying to invite people to submit that how do you find the missing writers, and sort of whether if it's not an anthology necessarily, but there's a certain, you know, someone's acquiring books of a certain sort and putting that forward. I mean, obviously that's going to be part of the imprint as well. But if, let's put it this way. I have read books that I thought, wow, this is amazing, and I would like to submit to X, Y, or Z. And every now and then I'll find, and this is happening with agents mostly, but you'll see in the acknowledgments, the author will mention, thanks to X, Y, and Z. And if they thank this editor or they thank this agent, suddenly it's like, okay, this is someone that I might want to start to contact. I guess I'm just asking, is that invisibility, does that have anything to do with accessibility? The invisibility of the editor?
Well, you see, in the genre,
I'm not quite sure what
as I say, what's breaking down now is the short lines of communication in the genre. Because, you know, you go to World Science Fiction Convention, the editors are there, everybody knows who they are, okay, and what they do. Okay, and if you're in the genre, you go to the World Science Fiction Convention, and you find that out. Okay. Or the World Fantasy Convention for fantasy editors. The editors are there, you find out who they are. And
you read the short story market or the writer's market, or most listings are still there with names.
Yeah, I'm not trying to say that's information cannot be found. But there was the question expressed earlier of finding writers who might not think that this is where they could go. And so I'm just wondering whether that's what...
Okay, I'm going to talk about another problem for just a moment. We get way too much to read. Every single day. Way too much to read. And we have to look at it fast, and we have to reject most of it as fast as possible.
So that's a question of input, too.
I was going to say, most publishers don't even read slush anymore.
That is part of it.
Only a couple do. Mm-hmm.
But not all.
And that's where I think, for the reader's experience... Ample material comes into play because you're reading certain stories by certain publishing houses because you trust that there is a vision there and that somebody has read this thing and thinks it's good, whether or not you agree with them, that there is something, some kind of intervention between you and them. Because if, as a reader, I had to read the way I have to read as an editor, I would not be a reader.
Ellen used the word casemaker at the very beginning of the conversation. And to be honest with you, that if Ellen is serving me something up, I know what I'm getting.
Mm-hmm. Whether you like it or not.
Yeah, whether you like it or not.
I know what I'm getting. I can count on this kind of work as opposed to people who will remain nameless who I know will be serving me fast food. And there's nothing wrong with it, but it's two different things I'm looking for. I'm looking for something quality to put on a shelf for a long time. I know that I can get it from Ann and I can get it from Alan. I'm not going to get it from Darrell Schweitzer. And that's just the way it's going to be.
Can I add, this is tangential kind of, but as, yes, you know what you're going to get, but I assume other editors, not just I, our tastes do change, they evolve, and we try to get new writers, and I want to be surprising. I don't want... I use a lot of the same writers because I really like what they're doing, but I think it's also the job of the editor to not be able to be pinned down. I mean, what the best compliment I ever got, although I want people to buy my anthologies, that's different, but when I was at Omni, the best compliment I thought of was, I have no idea why you bought that story for Omni. It's like, I have no idea how to... I have no idea what you want, so I don't know if... I'll submit it, but I have no... From writers, even... We don't know what you want. I said, that's good. I mean, I'm flexible. Yeah. I want everything.
Yeah.
But that's not true. It's inherently not true of editors.
Okay? Why?
The job of writers historically has been to figure out from context and example what editors actually want and try to send it to them.
Wow.
Only after they've written it, though. They shouldn't be...
After they've written it.
That's right. Correct.
I'll give an example. I know of no case where Ellen has bought sword and sorcery fiction.
I am not averse to it.
Counterexample to an author knowing, and somebody is a few years ago when Mary Rickard started publishing stories. She had no idea where to send them. She barely knew there was a field here. She kept sending them to mainstream presses. They kept trying to make them take the fantasy out, and it'll be a good story. And finally came across Gordon, I guess.
And
so she was not somebody who had any idea what the market was, and she was writing brilliant stories right in the middle of our market.
Yeah. Jeff Ford was like that. I met Jeff Ford when he first... The Physiognomy. Didn't that win the World Fantasy?
That wasn't his first novel.
He didn't know about the short fiction market. It was kind of a revelation going to World Fantasy.
I was going to say, there are cult classics. Gene Wolfe went to the library to Writer's Market because he wanted to sell a science fiction story. And he got to G and sent it to Galaxy, and they rejected it. So and he sent it to IF. And Fred Pohl, the editor of Galaxy and IF, bought it for IF and said, "Oh, I like the revision."
I,
So sometimes things happen entirely by accident.
Yeah. I think part of the danger of being in this field is that we are still kind of insular. We sort of look at in at each other.
Sure.
And the more that we can turn that gaze.
Indeed, there is always a danger to that. There's a comfort in that, and the comfort is dangerous. Mm-hmm.
That's why I missed Terry Windling's part of the Year's Best Fantasy and Horror, because I loved her introduction, because despite working in the bookstore, she would always have half a dozen books I'd never heard of that I wanted to read.
Yeah, looking at the just the list of recommendeds that did not make it into the Year's Best, and seeing, say, Olive Senior, who's like a Jamaican writer from Canada, who writes mainstream literary fiction, and seeing her there made me trust it more, because I'm going to find things I wouldn't find anywhere else. Even if it's just the recommendation, I always had a list, right?
And sometimes you're surprised by something that you think you don't want something, you think you're not interested in something. I've always had this personal, you know, thing that I don't like Christmas stories. So when someone sends me a Christmas story, I'm just that's like my automatic default. I'm not really interested in Christmas stories. And yet, this Canadian writer sent me not only a Christmas story but a Lovecraft. Another one of my notes for Weird Tales. And it was called My True Love Crap Gave to Me. It was the most amazing story. So, you know, I gave it a chance. I read it. I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe I love this story. It was a Christmas story, and it was a Lovecraft pastiche, but it worked. So sometimes you have to put aside your prejudices. You think you don't like something, and yet something comes along, and it just blows you away.
Yeah, I've done five anthologies of Christmas stories.
Hey, it's 11:55. People are applauding on either side of us, which means that they're done. So thank you all for coming.